Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today you'll be learning about the Z-Space production of The Making of a Great Moment from playwright-in-residence Peterson Nachtrieb. It stars noted comedic actors Danny Shy and Aishan Chelik. Also, one-man actor Dan Hoyle returns to our lovely studios to talk about the return of his show at the Marsh through the end of this month. Each and everything. Peter Robinson stands by to offer some music and some reading materials that will accompany your next screening of Dunkirk, as well as to let us know what's going on in local public libraries throughout this month. Stay with us. Well, a pleasure to be back with you as host of Open Air. My thanks to substitute hosts Judith Seeger for the past couple weeks, as well as Peter Robinson, who will probably be filling in a couple more times before the summer ends. Well, my first guest this week is a San Francisco-based playwright whose last play, a house tour of the infamous Porter Family Mansion with tour guide Weston Ludlow Londonderry, starred Danny Shay, who was also half of the duo in his current offering at Z-Space, The Making of a Great Moment. Peterson Nachtrieb is the playwright. His other works include The Totalitarians, which was seen at Z-Space in 2014, TCG's most produced play of 2009-10 called Boom, as well as several others. His works has been seen off-Broadway, across the country, and here in the Bay Area at ACT, the Encore Theater, Killing My Lobster, Marin Theater Company, Impact Theater, and the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. Peter is the playwright-in-residence at Z-Space, and this summer he rode his bike some 545 miles from San Francisco to Los Angeles to raise money to fight the AIDS HIV crisis for the AIDS life cycle, a ride that figured prominently in his creation of this play. Peter, that's welcome right to Open Air.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, before we talk about the big bike ride, which you and I are both big fans of, in general, bike riding, let's give us a brief synopsis, if you would, of The Making of a Great Moment.
So The Making of a Great Moment is a play about two actors from the Victoria, Canada region who have been cast in a show called Great Moments in Human Achievement that they're touring around the U.S. by bicycle. And in their minds, it's a very prestigious and amazing gig. It's a really long contract, and the two characters, Mona Barnes and Terry Deans, have very, very different reasons for why they're doing what they do. I think Mona is a character that really believes that art and theater changes lives, and that's her mission, is to bicycle all the way from Victoria, Canada, around our culturally impoverished United States and change and really affect people, whereas the Terry Dean character is more about the pleasure and the lifestyle of what it is to be an artist and to be a performer, and really savors the kind of the rhythms of moving from gig to gig and from show to show and putting in as little effort as possible. So they're kind of two philosophies about art and why they do what they do become sort of in conflict with each other on the road as they're sort of pushed to extremes. They bike about, 60 to 100 miles a day, in my mind. And and then they put on a show called Great Moments in Human Achievement that is theoretically 4 hours long. They're performing this in community centers, nursing homes, storage lockers, meth labs, a lot of alternative venues.
There's a lot of those in the culturally deprived United States.
Yes, sure. Exactly. Yes. So that they perform wherever they can, but they obviously it sort of throws them into sort of a crisis where they have to question why are they doing this? Why are they out committing their life to this this craft. And I've tried to do that with as many jokes as possible.
Well, this was written specifically with these actors in mind, I understand, Danny Shea and Aishan Chelik.
Yeah, so Danny and Aishan, as well as the director, Sean Daniels, and I all worked together on another play that I wrote called Bob in 2011 at the Humana Festival in Louisville, Kentucky. And I just fell in love with their voices. And
so both Danny and Aishan were in that?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
And in a sort of similar situation where they were playing multiple roles over the course of the play. It's a five-actor play with about 50 characters. And I just, both of their voices, they're absolutely incredible comedic actors. Mm-hmm. Danny lives here, and a lot of people have seen him at the California Shakespeare, at Berkeley Rep, and he has a voice that can pierce even the most dense of heads. It's and it can turn any innocent phrase into the most filthy thing you've ever heard.
And they cut down their characters to just two. In this, they each have a character. Is that correct?
They have one character, but that there is a play within the play that they're performing. So you get to see them as these characters, Mona and Terry, as well as all of these sort of historical, well, quasi-invented, fake historical figures that have had great moments and are responsible for a great moment in human achievement, like the inventor of the wheel or the inventor of the bicycle, actually. We have Baron Karl Dreis, who is from 1816. He invented the Laufmaschine in Germany as a result of a big famine and agricultural crisis where they had to kill a lot of horses because they couldn't feed them anymore. So his solution was to create the sort of earlier prototype of the bicycle. So he's Danny plays that character. Uh-huh. And Aishan plays the first metallurgist, for example. So they get a chance to, they're both amazing with their voices. So they get a chance to just kind of flex that muscle and try to entertain you.
So these great moments are history, are their own conceptions of what they think are the most important things that happened in the world?
Yes, exactly. And when I was sort of thinking about this, actually, it seems simpler. And then I read this book called Sapiens by, I think it's Yuval Noah Harari. I'm totally butchering his name. But it was a play that kind of takes, I'm sorry, a book that looks at the human species and why we have evolved to become sort of a dominant force on the environment and on the planet, and looks at these revolutions and these innovations and things that have happened that have made us such a powerful force. And it was a book that blew my mind and made the notion of what a human achievement is much more complicated in my mind. One of the most sort of head-shattering things he talks about in the book is how it was a human innovation to be able to collectively believe in things that don't exist. Whether that's a mythology or a religion or even a corporation, which actually has no physical, you can't touch a company, but you can only touch the things that it owns and that it employs. But because we've all collectively agreed to believe in it, it actually for some reason allows us to work together better as a species and group in larger groups than we normally would have been able to.
Well, that's serving as partial inspiration for your play. It sounds like some pretty heady stuff there.
It is.
But you obviously must have injected some comedy and lightened it up a bit.
I tried to pack as many jokes in as I possibly could over the course of the play, and it's very sort of layered. But at the underneath, I think, is that question of why we all sort of choose to pursue passions in our lives and often at the detriment to our well-being, at least for artists. I think that's the case, and I think that's the case for any kind of creator, whether you're a creator in tech or an innovator or an entrepreneur. We do something because we have this just gut need to do it, and this play is sort of an exploration of why do we do that, and a celebration of that creative impulse. And that's sort of the heart of the play. And I, as funny as the play is, that these two characters, Mona and Terry, I hope people will really sort of feel for them. And they're not the most ideal companions to for a long-term bicycling, high-pressure gig, but it's fun to watch them try to work it out.
And there are obviously the comedy is there, but there are problems that they encounter along the way.
Yeah, I mean, as a cyclist, you might predict some of their problems, and they're not very good cyclists. I think they were actors first, and then the cycling came second. So they're a little unprepared. Mona is the only one that sort of maybe knows how to fix a flat. She took an online class. She watched a video of a woman fixing a flat. That's how I learned how to fix a flat. The first time I fixed a flat, I had my phone and the YouTube video, and I was like going step by step to try to figure out to fix my flat while I was training for Life Cycle on the side of the road.
Well, fortunately, you've got a great support group for the Life Cycle. Tell us a little bit about that. Right. Well, before you do, it was your second video, how to tie a bow tie, perhaps.
Yes, I have watched a video for that too, and that was even less successful.
See, everything on the internet is true,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
It's all very helpful.
Yes, it's all.
So talk to us about what was like. Was this the first time you did the AIDS Life Cycle?
This was the second time, actually. So the first time, I think the reason there's bicycling in this play is when in 2015, when I was writing it was the first time I was doing ALC. And it's, for those who don't know, it's a 545-mile ride down the coast of California in support of the SF-AIDS Foundation and the LA LGBT Center HIV Services. It's a group of about 2,500 cyclists, and we're all raising money to help fight HIV, plus another 800 volunteers that are supporting you along the way.
I keep threatening to do it myself.
You should do it. There we are. We actually are having a bike to the theater night where AIDS Life Cycle will be there. And
fantastic.
SF Bike Coalition next Thursday.
Excellent.
And so I hadn't done a ton. I think I hadn't done a ton of road cycling before training for this in 2015, and I just fell in love with riding. There's something very sort of meditative about it, I think, because you always have to be avoiding death and having to focus on riding and not getting hit and keeping your line. There's a sort of meditation to it that I really loved.
And so you managed to do this without much training.
Well, I trained a lot. We started training both times in January. And the ride was in June, so we went out every weekend and just slowly built up our mileage from a 20-mile ride to adding 5 miles every week.
There you go.
So by the right before the ride, we were doing 70 to 80-mile rides, sometimes two in a row, and then the ride itself is a 7-day experience. The average is about 70 to 80 miles a day, and I felt physically ready, and also got to ride with an incredible team. Our team name was Team Whoops, which relates to the flat fixing predicaments that we often found ourselves in training. But that's the thing that's about the ride. If anyone's interested in doing it, is that you're not alone. You're supported
by
some of the friendliest people around that are all ready to help you and more than you even want, probably.
So you managed to avoid disaster on this ride. What were some of the more interesting things you saw on the ride this year?
Some of the interesting, I mean, it's always fun to ride through the farmlands between Santa Cruz and King City. It's one of our days, and to see all the workers in the strawberry fields and getting a sense of what backbreaking work really looks like, and seeing them actually running down the fields to drop off the baskets of the crates of strawberries, because they're paid on time and frequency.
Wow.
There's some sort of legendary food stops. We get a fried artichoke stop in one place. There's a on that same day, there's an otter pop stop where a bunch of bears and tutus have a dance party and give you popsicles. It's a really hot, sort of dusty. It's like Burning Man with bicycles and
popsicles.
It's a pretty incredible experience.
I think you just convinced me to sign up early on. So how much money did your team raise?
I raised about over $8,000.
Fantastic.
For people, and I think our team collectively raised about 50 to 60 grand, and then the ride itself raised 15 million.
Wow.
So it's a pretty incredible fundraising model, as well as building a community of activists and cycling enthusiasts.
So post AIDS HIV ride, what kind of riding have you been doing?
Well, I let my taint heal for a little bit. I think you can say that word on public radio.
Indeed.
Okay, good. So,
giving it a break.
Yes. So since I've done some city loops and such, I was supposed to do the Marin Century this weekend, but I think I let my training lapse a little bit. So I'm hoping to look for some longer group rides this fall that I can kind of use as a goal to... in the spring, it's just so beautiful here too, and a little less foggy, and it's a really great chance to kind of get out to the coast and out to, you know, West Marin and the East Bay Hills were pretty spectacular training around there, and the Russian River area. There's just so much to see, and there's such a wonderful way to experience nature is on the bike. And
have you experienced do you do mountain biking as well as road?
That's how I started. I grew up in Mill Valley, and I had a Marin mountain bike for a long time, and really loved that. And since I, there was some point that I got a little scared of riding, and I didn't do it for a number of years. And it really was until ALC that it kind of came back to it. And the city's gotten a lot more bike friendly in the last 15 years.
Still, defensive biking is the rule of the day.
Yes, there's now those Ford bikes are right.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Right,
they
next to my yeah. I haven't tried one yet. I'm a little nervous. I'm too tall.
Have you tried one of the e-bikes yet?
Electric?
No. It's a gas.
Really?
It's a lot of fun.
They just zip by you. I know. As a pedestrian, they scare me because I think bicyclist speed, and then they're much closer.
Very close to scooters. But I'm dying to try one to come up Mansell Street here because I have a very manual bike coming up Mansell Street.
If you keep going up Mansell, you go to the park, right?
Isn't that McLaren Park.
That was one of my first training rides. Was up Mansell Street, and I was like, oh my god, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this.
Well, getting back to the making of a great moment, which is at Z Space through the 26th of this month, at 470 Florida Street. From the press photos, it looks like we're going to be in for a truly creative production. Tell us a little bit about who you worked with for scenic design on this.
Our scene designer was a guy named Apollo Weaver, who's also an incredible scenic painter. And the idea was to sort of take some of the old-timey theatrical devices and use them in this show. So it was Sean Daniels, the director's sort of dream to kind of put some scenes in that sort of felt like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. So we have Mona and Terry do actually ride bikes on rollers where both wheels are moving in the play. And we've created this rolling backdrop of that kind of keeps, you keep seeing that same tree coming by.
Like the old Hanna-Barbera,
yes. over and over again. And Apollo hand-painted those drops, as well as the background is sort of three sort of proscenium frames with curtains. But the curtains are actually painted drops as well, and they each have different things behind them. So there's a lot of visual delight throughout the piece. We have a very fabulous sleeping bag scene. The solution of Apollo and Sean, you know, what there's a scene where they're talking in their sleeping bags, and how do you do that on stage and not just have them not lying on the ground? We have a wonderful platform that's that they're standing up on the sleeping bags, and both being incredible physical actors, they've convinced
that
you're suspended above them and watching them from on top.
Fantastic. Once again, the making of a great moment is at Z Below, 470 Florida Street here in San Francisco through the 26th of August. Talking with Peter Nachtrieb, the playwright, Danny Shea and Aishan Chelik are the performers. Something I'm really looking forward to catching tonight's production. And Peter, we look forward to having you as playwright in residence at Z Space talking about your next project.
Yeah, I hope to be there forever and ever and ever. And it's been a real treat to be a resident there.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. I want to ride it where I like.
You say black,
I say white.
You say bar,
I say bite.
You say shark,
I say him. And George was never my scene, and I don't like Star Wars.
You say Rose,
I say Royce.
You say God,
give me a choice.
Say Lord,
I say Christ. I don't believe in Peter Pan, Frankenstein or Superman.
All I wanna do is bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
The making of a great moment. Get on your bicycle and head over to ZSpace, zspace.org for more information. Peter's incredible production featuring Danny Shea and Aishan Shelik. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to Open Air actor Dan Hoyle with a focus on how the media and the digital experience resonates in the Trump era. Dan's wildly popular solo 2014 show, Each and Everything, has returned to the Marsh here in San Francisco. It's his updated version of his search for true community and connection in this fractured world. This acclaimed production was an instant hit with audiences and critics alike, earning the 2014 San Francisco Bay Area Critics Circle Award for Outstanding Solo Show. Dan was living in New York City for a couple of years and now returns home to his roots, San Francisco, and his roots at the Marsh, which has been home to Dan's world premiere shows, The Real Americans in 2010, Things They Happen in 2006, and Florida 2004, The Big Bummer. These shows have all received some wonderful acclaim, with the HuffPost praising Dan's brand of journalistic theater for its emotional depth and intellectual breadth. Dan, it's such a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves and our new digs here.
Yes, so nice to be back, David. Thanks for having me. It looks beautiful.
Thanks. Well, before we talk about Each and Everything, let's talk about Dan Hoyle, the New York year, shall we?
Sure, sure.
What did you learn when your experience in New York? Where were you living?
We just got back about a month ago. We were there for 4 years. We were living in the Bronx, the South Bronx, for the first about 2.5 years, and then we did a year and a half in Brooklyn. And
where in Brooklyn were you?
We were in Bed-Stuy mostly. Yeah. So we got lots of excitement. The biggest excitement is we brought a baby boy into the world.
Oh, Winston. Fantastic!
So he's now becoming a Californian, even though he was born in New York. So yeah.
Uh huh. And is this your dad, Jeff Hoyle's first grandkid, or?
Yes, it was my dad and my mom's first grandkid, and yeah, it was great. New York is endlessly fascinating / exhausting place.
It is.
So we had a good time. We were situated in the South Bronx, and I wrote a play about that neighborhood. That got a production in New York off Broadway. I guess that was last year, and performed The Real Americans off Broadway, and performed a lot this show, Each and Everything, at Joe's Pub at the Public Theater.
Fantastic!
And so it was a good time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you were still having an association with Columbia University as an artist in residence.
Yeah, the Heyman Center there, which is a pretty incredible place. The Heyman Center for Humanities, they gave me an artist, and I was an artist in residence for the last year, working on a new show that is in initial stages, and eventually I'll bring back to New York and eventually perform here as well.
Mm-hmm. So living in Bed-Stuy and Brooklyn, I lived in Park Slope for about 15 years, so I know New York well. What did you come away from New York saying, thank goodness we're leaving New York? what bothered you the most?
Well, I always say, like, nobody misses, like, Midtown. Like, nobody misses, like, Midtown on, like, a Tuesday traffic-y day, you know? It's funny because I was thinking about all the things that I won't miss. One of the things I guess I won't miss is people saying hello to you, looking down at your shoes, and then looking back up at you with a sort of a new take on their look, on their face.
Wow. That I did not notice.
There's definitely, it's interesting because I think the status on the East Coast is very much more direct. In the Bay Area, we try to sort of blur those status lines. I mean, a guy can be wearing, you know, like a fleece and running shoes, as everyone else does, and be worth, you know, $5.8 billion. You just have no idea. Whereas in New York, they're going to have, you know, a watch.
And a dress for the occasion.
They're gonna show out a little bit more.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about the negatives in New York. One thing I don't miss in August is that especially the heat of August, where every street smells like dog pee.
Yes.
It's just intense. And then you go down into the subways with the platforms that are 112 degrees and the subway cars themselves that are 52.
Right.
You're going
right
back and forth that you expect icicles to form on
right
you. Okay, so now the good things. What's some good takeouts?
The good
from New York?
Good takeout
from New York, of course.
Yeah, well, the roti spot, the pizza joint that was Biggie's old pizza joint. you know, we had a guy that our fruit guy in the corner that would give Winston. Winston would come by and he'd say, "Banana, you like banana?" And he would give Winston a banana every time.
Ah, sweet.
Bangladeshi guy. And then, you know, you go to the corner store and there's the Filipina lady who's like, "Winston, where's my ball?" And, you know, just all those sort of little villagey interactions.
And it's surprisingly how much there is there. I mean, everyone thinks everyone is in their own little world, but once you're in one of the hoods and you're a part of the neighborhood,
yep,
there are real people there, and yeah, people that will genuinely help you if you drop your wallet or your cell phone.
Sure,
or something like
that. Sure, yeah. I mean, it's sort of a higher bar to entry into somebody's circle, but once you're into their circle, you know, the crossing guard that we would walk by the park, you know, you sort of get your systems down, and there's so many interactions, you know. For Winston, I would just love it on the subway, being like, "Hey man, what's going on, little man? Give me a high five," you know. And I'm like, okay, so he's hearing this voice and that voice, and, you know, getting this person's face, and that's really exciting for a little guy, I think, as well as for me.
Sure. So that said, this new updated version, what sort of New York life experiences are now incorporated with the help of Charlie Varin and Maureen Towey?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I had wanted to bring this show back, but then The Real Americans kind of took up all my time. It got restarted last year when I did it in North Carolina, and then I sort of couldn't stop doing it because everyone was like, "Oh my God, this show feels like it's happening right now."
Charlie directed that as too, didn't he?
He did. I've been working with Charlie for 13 years.
He's an amazing guy.
He
makes everything happen at the Marsh. It's pretty amazing.
Supremely talented. Him and David Ford and Stephanie Wiseman have been, you know, the soul of that place, and it now produces, you know, shows that travel all over. You know, it's the best place in the country to create work, I think. I mean, I'm getting to go to D.C. later for 2 months. I'm going to Ireland. You know, all shows created at the Marsh. But yeah, so the new stuff. You know, because I started to think, well, you know, being a phone zombie now, it's like it at times it feels politically necessary. It's like, oh my God, what did Trump just say? You know, what's the latest? And yet, you could also sort of make the case that the sort of information siloed, filter bubbled, lost at our own private world and public space, never having random conversations with strangers, lifestyle paired with the bitterness of those folks who have not enjoyed the tech-led economic recovery, and you get yourself President Donald. That's a line from the show that I sort of say half jokingly, and the audience sort of goes, "Ooh."
Yeah, it's a collective sigh, I'm sure. Well, give us a little character sampling of some of the folks we'll meet.
Sure. So the new version actually starts out in New York with this guy Manny who I met just walking around, and he's like, "Yeah, nah, man. I mean, you know, it's not cool, you know, when everyone's just like on the Facebook and the Instagram and the Snapchat, you know. Like, I remember when I was a kid, like, you know, like watching the Jetsons, thinking like, oh, wow, the year 2000, it's going to be flying cars. Wow, yeah. Like, what was the name of the Hispanic guy on the Jetsons?" No, the world don't spend a guy in the Jetsons. Yeah, man, I used to worry, like, as a little kid, if cars start flying, like, all the Hispanic people, like, disappear, right? And he eventually starts to tell me about this story of that he lost his wife on Facebook, you know. And he's telling me, he's like, "Yeah, man, I wasn't even on it, man. Now I'm on it, you know." And everyone's like, "Hey, I bought a new bike, you know. I'm going to the Bahamas. I can't be like, hey, I'm depressed, you know. I'm living in a motel in Jersey. Yeah, check these new photos of these ice machines." Nah, man, it's supposed to be positive news, you know. But then he says to me, but he's like, "But you, man, I mean, you just getting me to spill my beans here on the sidewalk. Like, man, like, why do you do this, man?" And it sort of launches this story of why do I do this? And it takes me back to when I first started doing it, when I graduated college in Chicago in 2003, and I really didn't know what to do with my life, as many people don't. And I was hanging out a lot with my best friend Pratim, you know, and he was telling me, like, "Man, maybe you should stop listing freestyle rapping and Microsoft Word proficient as job skills on your resume. I mean, this is Chicago 2003, not Costa Rica 1999. And, you know, I told him, well, what I really want to do is I want to go and get to know the hustlers on my block. You know, we're the same age. We walk by each other every day, but we're like in two different worlds. And Pratim was like, okay, I don't think that's a job, man, but if you want to, just go talk to them. And so I did. And, you know, the first time I went up to this guy and he's like, what's up, Mo? You want to do a play about us? We're going to be a Broadway or a ghetto type play, because I do love me a good musical. And I eventually ended up hanging out with these guys the whole summer, and they sort of took me into their world. They crashed at my place, and I got real close, especially with this guy named Sino. And he was hilarious and also sort of very deep. You know, he sort of like, damn, I mean, right now I don't have a pot to pee in or a window to throw it out. When I was 16, 17, I was flossing. But now I'm just struggling. And so he was at a time that was really tough in his life, and we were both trying to figure it out. And I eventually lost touch with him. And then a couple months ago, I got back in contact with him through Facebook, which is one of the great ironies, you know, showing that the show is not a screed at all. It's very much trying to figure out how do we find balance, you know, in this new digital age. And I went back and hung out with him in the South Side of Chicago for two days, sliding around with him and seeing his whole world. And I really wanted to show that update. And so that there's a new epilogue in which I tell his story. And we're actually doing a couple of benefit performances for him because he's trying to sort of fully get out of the streets, and he's starting to take on work as an artist, and so as a painter. And so we're going to do some of that for him too.
Very nice. So that's some new things that have been incorporated into the show.
Yeah, because you know, the show is about finding this connection, and I eventually go to the digital detox, you know, where he says, hey, are you late, Dan? Yeah, I don't even know what time it is. Yeah. Oh, just give me a hug. But other side so hearts can touch. You know, and it's funny because I don't want to denigrate it, and I don't think the show does, because it rides that beautiful Northern California line, I think, of being both hilarious but also real and touching and open. And then I eventually go to India and go to the famed coffee house of Calcutta, where since, you know, the 18th century, intellectuals have been coming down from Europe, you know, as this guy says, and intellectuals have been coming down from Europe, and so it's interesting you have to come here to find your connection again. You don't know why you need to be here, but your people were the inspiration, so you have to be here, man. That is a spiritual fact. And I sort of and then I bring all that back, and of course within 2 weeks, you know, I'm like out of my ability to not go online, to not check Twitter, to not check Facebook. Mm-hmm. And so Pratim comes out and visits me, and then eventually the election happens, you know, which had not happened before I had last done this show. And all of a sudden it felt like everything changed, and Pratim is calling, you know, I called Pratim and I was like, you know, and he was like, I'm scared, man. I'm scared. You know, I people are saying and doing anything they want. And so I was trying to get him to, let's go out on another road trip, and he didn't want to go. And so I include me going back on a little road trip and then going and seeing Sino and talking about the importance, I think, or I don't talk about it. I show it. But I think it is important to make those connections across boundaries that sometimes can divide us. You know, I just think that it's always fun and interesting to get out of our comfort zones. But I feel like now it's kind of a political act on a certain level.
I imagine similar to the characters you brought from your experience as a Fulbright scholar in Nigeria, was it?
Yes.
So, character studies abound.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was just writing a piece about playing Pratim, and because he is prominent, he's the star of the show. And, you know, at one point he says to me, he's like, man, I had to go to therapy, man. I mean, my best friend was becoming me. But then I realized it was going to be okay. because it's actually been a part of me inside you all along. I mean, that's the point of connection, right? It's so much better when you find yourself in other people than when you just find yourself. And so, I feel like, you know, people always say, like, well, you're a monologuist. And I think, well, I don't really feel like that. I feel
much more than that.
I'm just playing a whole bunch of people. But I think on a certain level, for you to play them well, they have to sort of find a place in that lodges in you. And then the joy is in the audience, then, I think, seeing not just me playing these people, but the relationship I have with these people. And Pratim always says, you know, he's like, no, man, it's great that you do me, but what I really like is you doing you, because I see me in you, too.
That's Dan Hoyle, whose updated version of his 2014 one-man show, Each and Everything, is at the Marsh through the end of this month. Speaking of the 2014 version, it enjoyed performances not only here in San Francisco, where it originated, but also in L.A., New York, and Portland. How were those audiences different?
Well, it's funny. So New York sort of prides itself on being, it's like, yeah, no, we talk to everybody. We're cool. You know, it's like, there's no, I'm not prejudiced about nobody, you know. But there is a way in because there's so many people in New York, there is a way in which the phone is the perfect retreat, you know, because it's like, okay, I don't want to deal.
I always thought that the best New Yorker cartoon that has yet to be written would be everyone at a crosswalk looking at their phones and the phones say, walk. And they would all walk across the street.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I was writing this show, I remember going through an airport and somebody was on their phone reading the directions of where to go. Meanwhile, there was huge signs above us, like parking, turn right. And they're like, okay, hold on. It's not loading.
I have to go right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Oh, man. So we're also going to get a chance to hear you play guitar in the show.
Yes, yes. I have a new song that I wrote for this version. It's a ballad to a very famous, prominent social media kingpin. Rhymes with Dark Zucker Zerb. it's always a joy to bring some new songs, and it's always fun to throw some comedy and music into it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, being back in San Francisco, I mentioned that you had a chance to reconnect with your mom and dad. Jeff Hoyle, who originated the role of Zazu in The Lion King, was with Cirque du Soleil here in the Bay Area. His shows at the Marsh included Geezer and Lear's Shadow. What has he been up to lately? Have you had a chance to connect on an artistic level with your dad?
Sure, yeah. We were always comparing notes and talking shop. He's actually he's doing a show. He's doing a Shakespeare. He's doing a little Twelfth Night for. It's like a 3-week rehearsal process, and he's doing that. And then he's also working on a new piece that is yet to be untitled with David Ford. We sometimes talk about doing some more nights or doing a show together.
That'd be fun.
So we'll see.
Nice. Dan Hoyle's show, Each and Everything, is at the Marsh through the 26th of August. Shows on Thursdays and Fridays at 8 p.m. and Saturdays at 8:30. Information at themarsh.org. That's at the Marsh here in San Francisco, by the way. We're also going to hear, tell us about Phone Zombie. We're going to go out with that tune.
So this was actually a song I wrote, or the beat was created by Mars Today, a producer who now lives down in L.A., a kid I grew up with. He created this great beat, and there's some new lyrics now. This is the version that we recorded back in 2014, and then my friend Jake Futernick came up and we did a little video and threw it up on YouTube. So it's been fun.
All right, here it is, Dan Hoyle. Thanks for coming in, man.
Thank you so much.
Rah. face is stuck on his screen. I came up here to be social. No new friends to be seen. Not kicking it how we supposed to. When I came up, we be watching them streets. Now these young bucks got them personal screens. Pocket TVs, so they could screen out me. But what the fuck is going on? That's so much see. You're just a found zombie, found zombie, lost in space. Never saw me. See what y'all looking at, looking at. So engrossing, grossing. Instagram that drank, steady Facebook posting, posting. Think you be in private, but you overexposing. So get on that stripper pole, cause you information hoeing. I ain't gonna front, I mess with Netflix, blast some podcasts when I'm in the whip. But at a ballpark on public transportation, I'll be on that good, good grind for some good, good conversation. Used to ask directions to break the ice, but now dudes just be like,
is your phone all right?
Yeah, yeah, my phone's fine, I'm just dying inside. Guess I'll go home and cry and post a depressing ass line.
Paris Brands up in here. Damn.
What you want at dinner?
On that dinner.
That Snapchat. This ain't eye candy, baby. No, this eye crack. Eyes crack out, burnt out like Iraq. Urban warfare to disrupt, nope, distract. Checking email, cause you got a moment. Inbox full or empty, you still empty in that moment. Stolen, constantly communicating. Hating as we smiley facing. Grins and grins with smiley waiting for that telegram sensation. I made a comment.
Made a comment.
You look my way.
Look my
they
way.
Waiting, Gator Redwood. What you got to say? Curious. Ask me a question. Don't just Google it. I'm serious. I'm not socially frugal. Shit. Not just Googling. Now people goggling. Way more creepy than just analog. Ogling. Logging in. Logging out. Logging in. Open mouth. Aliens come down. Think that's what we all about. Who's your daddy now? And your mommy, touch screen baby, cause we all phone zombies. Phone zombie, phone zombie, lost in space, never saw me, just a phone zombie, phone.
The amazingly creative Dan Hoyle, a tune you'll hear along with some acoustic Dan and his guitar as part of his updated show, Each and Everything at the Marsh here in San Francisco through the 26th of August. Themarsh.org. For more information. And for Peter Robinson's segment, as we like to say, now for something completely different.
We're gonna hang out the washing on the secret lot. Have you any dirty washing, mother dear? We're going to hang out the washing on the secret lot, cause the washing day is here. Whether the weather may be wet or fine, we'll just rub along without a care. We're going to hang out the washing on the secret lot, if that secret lot's still there.
Interesting choice of song, Peter. Thereby hangs a tale, no doubt. Welcome back to Open Air, and thank you again for hosting last week.
Okay, yeah, good to be here, David. And indeed, that was that we're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line, which, and had you been in any of the London music halls in the 1939, 1940, you would have heard the comedians Flanagan and Allen singing their hearts out. But you would also have heard it on the other side of the channel as the troops beat a hasty retreat back from Holland, from France, from Belgium to the seashores of Dunkirk. And I'm doing a follow-up this week because a couple of weeks ago I reviewed the movie Dunkirk, which I liked, and people were good enough to call in or send emails saying that they too enjoyed the movie, but they were a little bit confused by the various cuts from the beaches to the planes to the little boats. So what I'm going to do is make a couple of suggestions this week of interesting books that cover in more detail the full story behind Dunkirk and how essentially what was a military defeat could be turned into a type of triumph. Because the one thing I did take from the movie was I felt I was back at Agincourt. The Brits were batting on a sticky wicket, and here we were in France, hastily hoping to get home again. And that, to me, really is the essence of the Dunkirk story. They were going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried line. So the first book is by Hugh Sebag Montefiore. It's a very detailed account of what really led up to the British Expeditionary Force, the story of how essentially 38,000 people were lifted off the beaches, and 338,000 people, just to get that figure correct, were lifted off the beaches, as opposed to the estimated 40,000 at the beginning. And he has done a lot of interviewing with the remains of survivors, gone through journals and diaries, and you get some of the kind of entries that in a movie you didn't have the time to present. Like one major in the artillery regiment clearly goes back to his old grouse shooting days, and he offers the gunners on the artillery racks £5, $15, if they can down a Nazi dive bomber. And he said, it's rather like following a pheasant. You know, get them in line and wait till the pheasant drops. So you're getting some of the inside talk that you wouldn't find in a movie where you've only got 102 minutes. And again, I think the other thing the book also recognises is the strength and the value of Churchill in particular. On the radio, with that famous Dunkirk speech, we'll meet them on the beaches. And I think that resonates. So if you're looking for a detailed history of why Dunkirk was a major turnaround, how the Navy, above all, managed to pull off this great achievement, and at the same time understand some of the diplomatic to's and fro's with the French, Sebag Montefiore gives full recognition to the fact that the French had to hold the perimeter on the outside through a very narrow corridor where the British were retreating. And you also get mention, which really wasn't shown in the film, of some of the war crimes. People at British troops, that is, at the church at Paradis, were simply machine gunned down by the Nazis after they had already surrendered. A second book, which I consider to be really good narrative history, is by Walter Lord. It's called The Miracle of Dunkirk. He too has done a great deal of interviewing on both sides, both German and British sides, French and Belgians as well. And he puts together, I think, a coherent story. When I say narrative history, it's good, it's easy to read, and in many ways it's more personal than history, yet at the same time it's more powerful than fiction. So he takes you inside the naval headquarters where Operation Dynamo, which was the name they gave to the Dunkirk story, was planned. And you get that sense of a day-to-day changes as Admiral Ramsay is making his various decisions. How many boats can be spurred? What can be sent? Can they send destroyers? He also deals with the question, which I think is the subtitle of his book, The Miracle of Dunkirk, is the three-day halt. This is when Hitler made the decision to halt for 3 days. The Panzer Division, which were only 10 miles from the front, were halted. In some instances, they'd run out of gas. In other instances, they needed repairs. At the same time, Göring, who was head of the Luftwaffe, was making his pitch that Dunkirk could be obliterated from the sky with the various dive bombers and other of the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. So again, that was a delayed decision. And then there was the third reason that some historians have suggested, that Mussolini already had an ambassador in London trying to negotiate a type of peace. And again, Hitler wanted it time to settle. So if you're into the nature of military history, how decisions get made, sometimes you want to turn to a book. The movie can excite you, it can motivate you, but a movie only has 102 minutes to tell a story. And something as major as Dunkirk may involve deeper research. And finally, there was Joshua Levine's book, which was the basis for the script that Christopher Nolan used. Again, more for movie buffs, I think, than historians. It cuts and shakes and goes back and forth. But at the end of the day, I'm thinking back in my own head to the music of the times. The movie finishes with a rousing piece of Mahler symphony, where, as always, the cymbals and the drums and the clashes of raising spirits takes place. In reality, what the books and what the stories tell and what the troops would have been singing was, in some case, a reflective song. We're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line.
Yeah.
Well, moving away from the shores of Dunkirk, back here to sunny San Francisco, you may be wondering, in the month of August, what is your connection with the local library or your local library? And I've taken a few minutes doing some research because I think what we've seen is what I call the changing nature of libraries. Libraries fulfills all its old functions as a place you go where you can get a book. You can maybe use a computer. But they have become, I think, in many ways, important social centres where they respond to community needs. And let me give you a couple of examples, things which you may not know. For example, August the 4th, 12 to 1, lunch is on us. So if you're going down to the main San Francisco Public Library, here is a chance for them to offer people in need to have lunch. Now, that may seem a far cry, as I said, from going in to renew a book or to get a book. But their gift to the community, I think, extends even further, particularly when it comes to children's education. And all major libraries across the Greater Bay Area, Marin, in the East Bay, and here in the city, have endless programs, very fruitful programs, encouraging reading and writing and study, and directed to attract young people. In fact, late this afternoon at Berkeley Main Library, they have a magician in there to entertain the kids. This is a way of getting you into the library. But for me, still the magic of libraries, and they're something I'm totally dependent on, really takes me to their reference desk. I call the reference library at Sausalito Library on a regular basis to do something unknown nowadays in the world of journalism, fact-checking. And so we have someone who will take the time, do the research, give you the answer, and you can be in some extent in the world of fake news that you're going to get reality spoken down that telephone. So I really respect the reference librarians across the Bay Area. I want to thank them publicly, thank them now, because I think for every journalist on deadlines, they can sometimes be the savior of the moment. And then we look at the whole question about immigration. Many libraries offer ESL programs, how to learn English. They have remedial reading programs, how to read English. And in terms of that whole question of literacy, I often think of that quip of Mark Twain, that a person who cannot read has no advantage over the person who does not read. So libraries are the nerve center when it comes to literacy. So my suggestion is check out your local library, not just for a book, but check out them for some of the social and community-based programs that really allow us to connect with books, connect with people, connect with learning, and connect in the very best social sense, even if you're only looking for lunch. And that's it for me for libraries this week.
Thanks so much, Peter. We'll see you again in a couple weeks, I'm sure. Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention a certain singer's birthday today, Anthony Dominic Benedetto. Born on this date in 1926, we know him and love him as Tony Bennett. Still going strong at the age of 91. So strong, in fact, that he'll be singing a concert tomorrow in Highland Park, Illinois. And then he has a concert in San Diego on the 15th and on the 18th in Wilmington, North Carolina. You've heard I Left My Heart in San Francisco, but I bet you haven't heard the verse to this very familiar tune. Enjoy it as we celebrate and send birthday greetings for Tony Bennett.
Poets often use many words to say a simple thing. It takes thought and time and rhyme to make a poem sing. With music and words I've been playing, for you I have written a song. To be sure that you'll know what I'm saying, I'll translate as I go along. Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words,
birthday to 19 Grammy Award winning Tony Bennett, age 91 today. Well, that's Open Air for this week. My thanks to Neil Swinkles, who brought this beautiful version of Fly Me to the Moon to my attention, as well as for co-producing the show with yours truly, David LaTulipe. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. By all means, send me an email about what you think about the show, david@kalw.org.